Hi, I'm Bob Acton, the host of the Color and Ceramics podcast. Today, I'm really honored to introduce you to Robin Harris. He is a crystalline ceramic artist based in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, whose creative path reflects both resilience and reinvention. A jazz musician, Robin turned to clay after a life-changing accident ended his drumming career, discovering ceramics in 2017 under the mentorship of Dave Settles at Fairview Studios. His artistic direction shifted again in 2020 when he encountered crystalline glazes, a discovery that opened a deep exploration into their unpredictable beauty and technical complexity. Through a practice rooted in experimentation, Robin creates work that balances cosmetic imagery with organic decay, revealing the delicate tension between creation and destruction. Each firing becomes an act of discovery, inviting viewers into a conversation about fragility, transformation, and the unexpected beauty that emerges when control meets chance. Let's meet Robin. Robin, thanks so much for joining us on the Color and Ceramics podcast. We're really pleased that you're here today with us.
Well, thank you very much for having me, Bob.
Yeah, it's absolutely. You're a fellow Calgarian, and I had a chance to see your work at one of the Christmas shows, and your crystalline glazes are just gorgeous. And so I'm really looking forward to having a conversation with you today about your work.
Yeah, it was quite interesting to meet you there, actually. And I was also quite impressed when I saw your table set up there.
Thanks very much. Now, are you done all your sales for the Christmas season? I know I'm done all mine.
Yeah, I didn't do a lot of markets this year. I typically don't do very well at the markets. So I didn't partake in a lot of them. I did the APA show, which was quite successful. And I actually quite liked that market because it's a pottery market. So people coming have some understanding of pottery, or they at least appreciate it. And it was nice to see the other potters like yourself and get to know some of the other people. It was my first year joining the APA. So nice to people and see all the nice work that was there. So that was cool as well. It was quite diverse.
Awesome. Speaking of diversity, you are a pretty diverse guy yourself. You have a strong history in jazz musicianship. You're a drummer, and you're a physical fitness trainer, as well as doing an outstanding job with ceramics. So I'm not going to ask you to explain your journey in all three of those, although you can merge them in there if you wish, but I would like you to explain a little bit about your journey in clay, like where you started from and how you got to where you are today.
Well, to be honest, the stories are pretty interwoven how I got into clay. I was living in Asia for about 12 years. Between there, I lived in Montreal and New York for a couple of years as well, but I always kind of ended up back in Asia somewhere. There's quite an interesting music scene there. I really enjoyed it. It's quite gritty and a lot of creativity. And so I was able to do a lot of different styles of music there, which was really nice. There was a lot of African and Brazilians there as well. So I got to do a lot of that kind of music. But while I was living there, touring around, especially Japan and in China, I really started getting smitten with the idea of ceramics. And so I started off just appreciating it. And then I kind of wanted to get into it. So I signed up for the university program in Hong Kong. For ceramics. And I was working on some movies there because I was doing a lot of action movies there as well, because I have a background in martial arts and gymnastics and parkour. So I could be the white guy that gets killed by the Chinese guy and do stunts, and they didn't have to find a stunt guy. Also a precision license, so I could do all the car stunts. And literally a week before I was supposed to start on that ceramics course, I was practicing a stunt off the top of the building and shattered my right leg. So that kind of ended my professional drumming career. I was never able to tour again because the surgery they did in Hong Kong was very poorly done. So about a year later, my ankle fell apart again and they wanted to amputate my leg. So I ended up going to the States where I could get private care, and they did a reconstruction that allowed me to walk and use my leg, but not enough to still go and do a 3-hour rehearsal, a 3-hour gig, fly to another city, 3-hour rehearsal, 3-hour gig. So that all kind of ended for me. So from that, I was doing my rehab at a gym. It's a long story, I know. And the owner of the gym liked what I was doing and kind of procured me to be one of their trainers. Then I ended up being very good at working with elderly people and injured people because I'm very good at finding injuries. And then I met another personal trainer who became my girlfriend, and she heard my story about the ceramics. So she got us a 4-week introductory course at Fairview Studios in Calgary, run by Dave Settles at the time.
Yeah.
I was really good at it immediately, and I loved it, and she hated it. A year later, she left me because I spent too much time at the pottery studio. While I was at the pottery studio, I ended up meeting my current wife and the mother of my child. So it all worked out in the end because I have a fantastic wife now. She's definitely the right person for me. And I found her at Fairview Studios as well. She's from the Netherlands and very supportive of my arts because you need a partner that's supportive if you're going to do arts. So that's how I got into clay. And Fairview Studios was just, at the time I was there, it was pre-COVID. So everybody was nice and things were just more lax in the world. You know, things were just a little different. And it was such a fantastic place to be because there was no limit on studio time. Dave was very free, almost too much so, where you could just stay at the studio all night if you wanted. And he was a great teacher for me as well, for my learning style, I guess, because if you asked him a question, he would just say, I don't know. I'm sort of doing this. I guess you got to figure it out. And that's always been good for me to kind of find my own path. Some people didn't like it. They wanted more very detailed instruction, but I really thrived in that studio. It was the right place for me indeed. And Dave was a great teacher for me that way. And boy, he just let me have free range there, man. He let me do all sorts of glaze experiments. He let me play with all the gear. Sometimes I broke it and he was very forgiving. And I spent a lot of time there at the time. Yeah.
That was a great studio. I did some work with Dave many, many years ago. And so it's nice to see that you also connected with Dave. He was a great teacher.
Yeah, it was the perfect fit for me. And that studio was fantastic. It's since kind of changed hands, and Fairview now is in a different place run by Dad and Green. And it's still a great studio. I recently had my wife convinced me to kind of get my own wheel and everything, so I don't belong to any studios anymore, but I still finished off at Fairview at their new location down the street from where it was.
Cool. Hey, you know, I have a question for you, because one, that's exactly was my path as well. I worked, started at a little city-run studio here in town, and then ended up at Dave's and worked there for a few years, and then we bought a new house, and I had an empty basement, and I thought, oh, perfect, I'm going to put my own studio in. But it works great. But one of the things that I find is that I get a little lonely in that studio because I'm all by myself. I don't have anybody around me to go, hey, Bob, what are you doing that for? That's kind of a dumb idea. Or, you know, that's a great idea. Or tweak this or tweak that. How about for you? How do you find working alone in your studio?
Well, I'm an only child, so it really suits me. It suits me more, to be honest. I find I can just have all the focus I want. I can listen to whatever music I want, not what's being played. And sometimes, again, unfortunately, post-COVID, I find most conversations that happen in public places are a bit spiky.
Yeah, how so?
So I found that all a bit distracting too. Like the studio environment before all that happened was always pretty cordial, and people still had a good time, and they could agree to disagree and stuff. And now I find everywhere I go, not just the pottery studio, most places I go that is in public, things are very heated and divided and apoplectic almost. So for me, it was actually a nice time to remove myself because I found it distracting when I was throwing. And I don't like to throw with headphones with music. I can't hear the clay, I can't hear the wheel, and that. And for me, being a drummer, I guess part of the reason maybe I'm good at clay is because I can kind of hear the rotation of the wheel, so I know how fast and hard I'm going to pull. I typically wheel throw. I don't do a lot of hand building. So for me, it was a great time to move on to myself. If I have music on a stereo that's not right against my ear, I can still enjoy that. But when I find headphones, I don't throw as well in headphones.
Isn't that interesting? I'd never thought about the interface between drumming and sound and rhythm and the wheel. But as you've explained it, it makes perfect sense.
Yeah, you know, even on I have a whisper, but it still has some indication of how fast it's moving. And I find that is probably why I was always good at centering and pulling evenly, because I think just naturally you could kind of feel that tempo and that rhythm of the wheel and pull at the right pace, right? That's very important for pulling walls.
Yeah, for sure. Hey, that's great. Good stuff. Hey, now tell us a little bit about your work. Of course, we've seen it and we think it's awesome. But tell us a little bit about your work and what you're enjoying doing these days, and maybe do it in a manner that would allow the listener to be able to understand your work as best one can.
Yeah, sure. Well, I appreciate the kind words. I used to be really into stoneware and a lot of textures. I liked a lot of the black iron clay from PSH and whatnot. And I still love that stuff. But I stumbled across a guy named Jose Mariscal and Matt Horn were the two guys that really turned me onto crystalline ceramics, which is almost always done on porcelain. So I really got into porcelain and developing crystalline glazes, which has a huge learning curve. My wife calls me a glutton for punishment because of it. There's a lot of chemistry involved. There's a lot of luck involved and a lot of finesse. I find it the most wearisome of any of the methods of glazing I've tried. But when the results turn out, for me, they're spectacular. It's almost a bit of an addiction, because I will be up at night still thinking, like, if I just tweak this glaze a little bit here or there, or if I change the firing temperature, what else could come up, right? Like, I have endless ideas for glaze results. It's just a matter of time, because it's very time consuming. And like you said, I have a kid now, so there's a young kid really evaporates some of your time, as you probably know here. But zinc crystalline glazing is, I get asked all the time when people see the crystals in the glaze, if I've epoxied them in or if I set them in afterwards or something. And it's not that. It's a glaze chemistry that has a high saturation of zinc, typically at least 25%. And every flux, every colorant that you add will change the temperatures that work. And you try to find the temperature in the kiln that the crystals will start to grow. And you'll have maybe for every glaze, you'll have five or six temperatures that create different textures of crystal, different colorants of crystals, and different opacity of crystals. So there's so many combinations, like trying to open a safe. And so you have some input as to what the crystal's structure and what the overall halos, there's many halos if you want, are going to look like. And then the glaze kind of improvises and decides where those crystals are going to be and how much background there is or not. And that's how much zinc you put in. There is a method of placing zinc site inside, like little bits of zinc site inside your bisque ware, and guarantee there will be a big crystal that grows there. However, they typically leave a little bit of a sharp edge. So if it's on a mug or something, it's typically not pleasing to hold. So I don't do that very often. I do it sometimes on my big platters. My favorite thing to throw, of course, I like throwing big. I love throwing huge platters that are as flat as I possibly can without flopping. The unfortunate side of it is they're incredibly hard to sell. So I have a ton of them, and they're very expensive and very precarious. So I'm not throwing a lot of them right now, but the big platters give me the most canvas to work on. And a lot of crystalline potters typically just use one glaze on that piece and keep it elegant and sweet. But I really like to blend glazes. And I find on those platters and those big platters, the way they can kind of cascade into one another and pool together in the bottom, you can get some spectacular results. But like I said, it's just, I can only store so many of them.
Yeah. You know, I often think that ceramics requires us to have great patience. And as I'm listening to you talk about all the variations that you can have in your glaze process, I can see why you have to have a lot of patience as you're going through the various combinations and trying to figure things out.
Sure. And I mean, kiln firings are close to 30 hours sometimes. So when it doesn't work out, it's an expensive loss, right? And the glaze has to run off the pot. So you have to throw a catcher that fits the base of the pot exactly, which I have a hard time. I get a lot of questions on my website from local potters that want to try crystalline glazes in their community kilns. I can't stress to you enough, if you're going to make a catcher, that the glaze will fall on. Otherwise, your community ceramic studio won't be very happy when the kiln shelf is completely full of your glaze.
Yeah, very cool. Very cool. Now, where have you, so you talked about the big pieces as being the thing that thrills you the most in making, because it creates this big canvas for you to have lots of different shapes and colors on. What's been your biggest challenge as you've had to work through these experiences?
To be honest, Bob, my biggest challenge up until today is being able to sell my work and get enough money to keep doing it. I find it it's because it's such a niche market. And it's like most of my interest for my pieces is from the US or from Europe. I have very little interest locally, unfortunately. And now with the extra tariffs and stuff, and shipping is so expensive no matter what, I find a lot of that. I still get a lot of interest, but once you give the total with exchange and all those kinds of things, it's not really practical. My wife is from the Netherlands, and she keeps saying if we were there, I'd have no problem. I would do great. Locally, I find it harder. A lot of the galleries I've contacted or been suggested to contact, they typically ask me if I have anything with a wolf or a bear on it. And I that's just not really what I do. There's nothing. I think that's still great pottery. I'm not denigrating it, but it's just not. Once I dig into something, Bob, I really kind of, I'm all in. So I feel like Sisyphus, but I just keep pushing up the hill, trying to make it work no matter where I am. Right. I mean, that's how music was, you know that as well. Cause you have that musical background as well. Once you get in, you just got to keep digging and be true to yourself and know that, you know, I'm honest with myself that I know I'm doing good things. And the last couple of years in particular, I've had a lot of support from local potters. Ceramics Canada has been amazing. They've been so helpful for me. And again, I'm very lucky. My wife sees the struggle, but she's like, you can't stop. You got to keep going because every batch is better. So I have a lot of moral support, but I just need to figure out how I can monetize it a little bit better. I'm not looking for this to buy me a mansion, but it would be great if I could pay myself for my time. Because right now I make about enough to cover my costs, but not my time. And it would be great if I could pay a living wage while I did it, because I really love it. So it's not hard for me to do, but I think I've finally reached a level of quality that maybe deserves that, I guess.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I can see that for sure. Your work is gorgeous. And I think the thing that you're talking about, which is this idea of the struggle of selling, is something that I've seen lots of potters experience. That it's, and you know, you talked about the challenges of selling it away from your city, and that is that you can't deliver it, so you have to ship it, and shipping costs are, I mean, just the packaging of some of your work, which is pretty big, would be that takes time and energy and specific techniques that are going to allow the piece to get there in one section.
I've had some terrible breakage where you're just, oh man,
yeah.
Would have not sold it. It was a nice piece.
Yeah, I know that's a real challenge. I guess maybe the step that many potters, ceramic artists, I think artists in general have, is how do I get rid of my stuff? How do I sell it into the market? And, you know, you talked about your music background. I see lots of creatives have the same challenge, whether you're in the music industry or whether you're an actor or a writer or an artist of some sort. It's, yes, you can produce beautiful work, and then it's getting it to market and finding that market where people are really interested in your piece.
You bet. I mean, it's the comparison of a bottle of water in Iceland is $17 and a bottle of water in India is 25 cents, right? Same bottle of water, it's proximity. So there's definitely that consideration. I've been suggested many times to just get into stoneware to make the money and then do the crystalline kind of on the side. But again, for me, my time is thin, so thin right now that I really, I'm not that concerned about it, to be honest. I'm just going to keep my nose to the grindstone and stay true to myself. And hopefully eventually, you know, I'm a bit long in the tooth for the social media thing, but you know, every once in a while, the right influencer buys somebody's mug and shows it. And all of a sudden you have an order for 10,000 and you're good. Right. So I think that's what everybody's holding on for, but my hopes are low, but I keep my chin up, man. I'm not going to stop.
Yeah. It's really important to do what you love. And I heard somebody the other day talk about, well, you could do what you love and be broke. And so I think there's often the marriage between being practical, finding an audience that will purchase your stuff, a group of clients, and what you love, right? Being able to merge the two together in some way. And that's, I think, often the challenge for sure.
Well, I'm lucky because I do quite well with my personal training or my injury rehabilitation business. I'm self-proprietor. I don't work at a gym. I have my own. And so that is a pretty good wage that kind of gets me by. And like I said, speaking of the marriage of the art and whatnot, I'm again, just very lucky to have a partner that is okay with me not making more money than I do and this time to a craft that doesn't bring a ton in. I can't appreciate that side of my wife more. It's fantastic because I have many friends that even just musicians that are always kind of catching flack because things are slow or something like that. And my wife, just even at times where I'm questioning it, she's like, no, you got to keep doing this. So I'm really lucky that way.
This may be a question you can't articulate, I don't know, but what is it about that kind of work that you're doing that really excites you?
It's the infinite possibility to me. And I think this is actually also part of what gets in the way of me finding a market is typically people want something that they've seen, right? They want this specific shape of mug that has this specific glaze combination that's reliably the same all the time. And that becomes kind of the marker of that potter, and they do quite well, unless you're like Tom Coleman or Lisa Hammond, who's famous enough, they can just be very individual vessels, but because of the name and because they're great potters, they can generate, you know, $6,000 for a Yonomi, which is amazing. But for me, you know, even my mug shape, I'm hesitant to settle on one mug shape because depending on the glaze, you know, sometimes the mug shape or the bowl shape or whatever it is what also what determines what kind of glaze I'm going to put on it instead of just having this, like, this is my standard mug. So I'm probably not doing myself any favors with that. But what excites me is the fact that every piece that I make is completely, it's a one-off. And especially with crystalline glaze, it will never come out the same. It'll come out similar, but not the same, right? And that's something that really is attractive to me. It's part of what I loved about the music. I improvised music because I was mostly into improvised music more than pop music, though I played pop music. It's just you never knew. We're going on stage with a general idea of what's going to happen, but in between those two bookends is a whole new story every night, hopefully. And with the crystalline pottery, I found it opened the gates to being the same thing. It's tragedy is it's unreliable, but its attractiveness to me is also that unpredictable, unreliable part. And often I'll open the kiln and be devastated because I have expectation. Again, my wife's good about being like, hey, don't throw it all away yet. Just put it in the garage for a week and go look at it later when you've forgotten what you thought it was going to be. Which is great advice because every time I go back, I see it with fresh eyes and I'm like, oh, wow, I need to write this down. How do I get this?
Yeah, you know, it sort of feels like you're a mad scientist up there trying to figure out all these kind of nuances with the chemicals. And I know I used to do a lot of woodworking and it was pretty simple in lots of ways. You would put the piece together and sand it down, put some oil on it or finish on it in some way, and then you are good to go. But this ceramics is crazy with the chemicals and the reactions that we have with the materials.
Yeah, indeed. And I mean, that's another thing that keeps me excited is I keep exploring more chemicals that you can use for crystalline because, you know, typically the crystals are on a part of the pot that is not food safe, right? If I'm making a mug, I line it with a food safe glaze, but crystalline glazes aren't. So it kind of opens the doors for all sorts of chemistry. So I've been playing with tungsten trioxide, silver nitrate, neodymium, erbium, praseodymium, cerium, all these weird rare earths and things like that. I just have the type of personality that when I read an article that says, you know, these don't mix these, they won't work. I'm like, nah, I can figure out how to make those work. So I'll sit there and do 100 glaze tests until I get something that's beautiful from them and be like, ah, see, I can make it work.
Yeah. Now, when I met you and we were talking about your work, you were talking about your firing process. And so when you say, oh, I make a bunch of test tiles, it's not just that easy as many of us who might do it in a more simple way. You've got a very complex firing schedule that you use. Tell us about that.
Well, first off, the test tiles that I make are usually a bit more involved than a regular test tile because, again, the glaze has to run enough that you're kind of throwing a cylinder with a little lip up the bottom to catch the glaze. They take a bit more time. But the firing schedules, I don't have one firing schedule. And my firing schedules continually change. And even as the kiln, like I use the APM elements so that I get few more firings out of it because like bismuth subnitrate and the tungsten and things like that corrode the elements. So you want the best elements you can get. But at about 100 firings, the kiln is not running as fast through temperatures, right? So your crystal structure changes because if I slow down the temperature, I move between between those halo temperatures I'm going to go to, I can actually kind of stretch the crystals. I can make them look a bit different. I was working with another very talented potter photographer named Kelly Hofer, also at Fairview Studios. And for a while, we were working on a project where he did macro pictures of the crystals, which blew my mind. The prints would have been better than the pots, in my opinion, because you can see things happening on that level that you can't see with the naked eye that just were amazing. But it didn't really, we weren't able to get all the way to the finish line with that, which is unfortunate. But my firing schedules are between 20 and 30 hours, typically, maybe a little longer if I'm really trying to experiment with something. And it's continually evolving because, like I said, every element I add to a glaze is going to respond to different temperatures, all the way down to maybe 600 degrees Celsius, all the way up to 1120 Celsius is typically the range I'm firing in between. And how you move through those temperatures makes a substantial difference to how the crystal is going to grow, or if there's a lot of secondary crystals, little tiny ones in the background, or if you're just going for one big crystal. So it really, every time I fire, to be honest, I don't reliably settle on one schedule. I have a book with like 150 pages of workable crystalline firing schedules, depending on what I want. And I wish I was better at documenting it with pictures and whatnot, but I just write like little crib notes beside it saying, you know, lots of secondaries at this temperature or whatever to document it. So it's ever evolving and I'm always playing around. Typically you have maybe 8, 10 at the most hours of actual growth time for the crystal. So you have to choose how you want to appropriate that time to the crystal itself. If you want a lot of secondaries, you're not going to have as big as initial crystal. If you want a bigger initial crystal, you're going to have to sacrifice some halos and some of the secondary crystals. So there's a lot of decisions before you press start on that kiln after you program it as to what you want that batch of pots to kind of look like. And sometimes it's amazing how a small change and you open it up and like no crystals formed. They should have. It wasn't that much of a change. It's a half an hour change maybe. But somehow that doesn't work. And so there's a whole batch that you can try to reglaze and hope, but most of the time that they are what they are, right? Reglazes sometimes work and sometimes it's so you just wasted another firing.
I could see this being turning into a book for you. You're a very detailed guy, and we called you the scientist, so you're always checking different things. And I could see lots of people who might want to try this kind of work would have a hard time. Like, you can't just go to a class and take that at a local pottery, generally. Have you ever thought about writing, creating an online program, or writing a book in some way?
I kind of have, but I just feel there's already a couple of guys doing that are kind of masters of the art. And I kind of feel if people are interested in that, I would more just direct them towards those guys. I don't know, maybe there's room for me to put my own book out, but I guess I'm also a bit precious about the things I've figured out and worked out because there's been so much trial and error, like literally years of making it work. For me to sell it and see other people. I mean, you're never going to produce what I'm producing because even atmospherically, if you're in a different elevation, it's going to change how it works out. It's super finicky, man. Like 5 degrees difference is enough difference to totally change the outcome. But yeah, no, I've kind of kicked that idea around a few times, Bob. I just at the end of the day, I'm like, would somebody buy it from me, or would they just go to Jose Mariscal and,
Well, and it takes more time. Like, writing and documenting and doing all those things takes a long time. And so, if your time is precious, and so you're going to put that effort and that time into where it counts most.
And like I said, I'm already so limited in my time right now that I was in Ceramics Canada the other day, and they were saying to save some money, I should just make slip out of the porcelain and put it on a cheaper clay body, which is a great idea to save money. Bowman's porcelain is like 130 a box now, so it ain't cheap. But the amount of time and testing that would have to go into that, I just don't have it. So for me, I'd rather just pay the money for the clay and just continue on the learning curve I already have kind of set before me. I'm up at night still, even when I'm super tired, just with ideas of new glaze formulas. I can't stop it. I think that's the addiction, and it is an addiction. It's something that it would be handy to be able to turn off sometimes because it keeps me up when I need sleep, just thinking about possibilities and different firing schedules. And different blends of glazes. It's just infinite. And I think that's still what tantalizes me most with crystalline, why I can't step back to just doing some stoneware stuff. And again, I'm not denigrating that at all. There's great stoneware work out there, but I found, and it's my passion right now.
That's very cool. It's nice to see somebody who has a similar thinking style as I do. I'll often be sitting on the couch, and my wife will say, "What are you thinking about?" And I'll say, "Oh, I'm just thinking about clay." Like, it never stops. Hey, now, have you got any advice for a more, I'll call him a junior potter, or somebody maybe who's just wanting to get into the crystalline kind of work? Have you got some advice for people along that line?
Don't do it. I don't know. There's a couple of potters that, or even at the APA that I was talking to, that were really wanting to experiment with it. And I think that's fun if you want to just experiment with it. But if you want to get into it, you have to understand that this is going to take you on a very long path, that you're going to have some real failures for a while. There's a lot of steps to crystalline that aren't in other forms of pottery that you really have to figure out kind of for yourself how you want to throw your catchers. There's different ways to throw catchers that work differently. Getting them off, it really is. If you step into it, it's a bit of Pandora's box. It's a big step, and it's going to hook you like it did me, most likely. Unless you're easily disappointed, and then you'll probably walk away from it quickly. But if you're not, it's going to take you for a ride for sure. And like I said, the investment's huge, right? The glazes are very expensive. Even on pots that are successful, about a third of that glaze is going to come off the pot into the catcher. So that's just money out. And the catcher has to be a similar clay body so it fits and shrinks at the same. For a while, I tried to use cheaper stoneware for my catchers, and then I noticed it was cracking the bottom of my bigger pots. And it's because the clay is shrinking slightly. And at the end, it just twists the foot and cracks, because the cracks weren't pressure cracks or S cracks. And I was having a hell of a time figuring out what was happening. It was driving me crazy. And then I realized as soon as I went to porcelain catchers, it wasn't happening anymore. So just that extra 2% shrinkage or whatever is enough at the end to torque the bottom of the foot to put a spiral crack right by the foot. So all those kinds of things, you know, that's how many pots did I throw away because of that till I figured it out. And that will be the path doing this. So if you have the time and the finances to experiment with this, like if you were retired and you have your own studio and you're fairly well off, totally, this is great. This is going to keep your brain young forever because it's endless, right? And you're always going to be figuring things out. But if you have limited time and you're trying to do this as a hobby, but like as also a side stream of income, be prepared if you're going into crystalline, right? You really, if it's not your passion, it's just going to beat you up and you're going to hate it. And you're going to wreck your kiln. There's always, if one of your catchers cracks, man, all that glaze, it's going to drip on the shelf and hopefully not off the shelf onto the kiln floor or onto your elements. Or there's also the problem that sometimes a pot will slip off a catcher at the top of the temperature and lean up against the side of your kiln. Now you're losing bricks, and that you go your kiln bricks also because of the crystallobite that's created from the crystalline glaze. So it ages your kiln bricks much faster. It corrodes your elements much faster. Firings are 30 hours, so you're going through elements much faster, right? So just all of those things, if you're not really passionate about it and patient and willing to suffer, I guess, for it, they're gonna make you resentful. And I've had periods. I've definitely had moments where I'm just like, screw this, man. I'm done. And you know, it passes, and then the next firing goes really well, and then you're back in it, just like a drug addict, man.
I was thinking that sounds like golf, you know, you get a, in some ways. Yeah. Well, that's interesting. I think what I hear you saying is that it's okay to play with it, but be prepared. It's going to be very complex, very time consuming, very expensive to get anywhere with it when you're moving in that direction.
And it's fraught with failure. Even now, I mean, I have a lot of variables dialed in, so I don't have a lot of failure, but every once in a while, there still is a time where you open the kiln and you're just like, ah, you gotta be kidding, right? I mean, I see that also with like wood firing, everything. There's always that proximity possibility with clay, but I find crystalline's probably the most precarious. If you're willing to accept that, get into it, man. Send me an email. I'm very open with my information. Reduction firings can do some really cool things too with crystalline, because if you're doing a post reduction firing, you can find just the temperature, so just the crystals change color, but the background stays the same. So I find the possibility with reduction firing and crystalline even opens up more windows of opportunity, because you're not just reducing a whole pot. Because those crystals, the porosity of them is different than the background. If you get your temperatures right, you can make a crystal turn red with a nice blue background or purple background. So just, again, spectacular results when it works.
Wow. Alchemy. Nice.
Yeah. So if you're interested, feel free to send me an email. I'll do my best to answer you and stuff like that. But just go into it knowing it's a long learning curve. It's gonna beat you up a bit. But there is a reward if you're willing to be patient enough, I guess. If you're sitting, you'll never get there, but you'll feel like you're making progress.
Hey, Robin, thanks so much for spending time with us today. This has been fascinating, and I think our audience will really enjoy hearing about some of your challenges that you've had and that they might have if they get into it, and how much you love the work that you do.
Yeah, definitely. It's definitely passionate.
Super. Thanks so much.
Yeah, thanks for having me, Bob, and keep doing what you're doing. I love your pots.
Thanks so much.